May it please the court, and good morning again. I am Morris Grimm from St. Louis, and it is a pleasure and an honor to represent Kelly Glossop in this case, and I also feel that I am in some way also representing Corporal Dennis Englehart, a member of the Missouri State Highway Patrol who died Christmas Day 3 years ago. And I was a member of the Missouri State Highway Patrol, and I think I speak for many people in this room who would say it's the finest police organization in the country. The issues before the court are very narrow. They're not broad issues. And so I do want to explain that what this case is not about. It's not about the marriage amendment. It's not about whether same-sex people can marry each other or not. This is an employee benefits case, pure and simple. And it is our position, and we feel strongly, that the two statutes involved here, Revised Statute 104.0403 and 104.012, did violate the constitutional rights and the right of equal protection for Kelly Glossop. It's important, I think, to understand that 104.040 provides for retirement benefits. It also provides for death benefits, and we understand that being a member of the State Highway Patrol and being a trooper and working our highways is a position of risk. And too often we drive up and down the highway and see the name of a trooper somewhere who's given his life serving us Missourians. But it is a position of risk. And so the statute provided for death benefits for the spouse of deceased troopers. And that's the term that's used in the statute. And then in 2001, the legislature made it very, very clear by adding a statute saying that only opposite sex surviving spouses of deceased troopers would receive those benefits, and that under no circumstances would the surviving partner of a committed, interdependent gay couple, one of whom happened to be a trooper, under no circumstances would that survivor receive those death benefits.
Does the statute provide for benefits for children?
It does. It provides for benefits for the spouse first, and then to the children if there's no surviving spouse divided. The deceased did not have children. Kelly did.
So the result is no benefits?
The result is no benefits. Yes, Judge Stitt, that's correct. So the position as is articulated in the briefing, I think in this case, I hope the court agrees from both sides, and particularly the amicus briefs also, is excellent. I mean, the court has, I believe, before it, the information necessary to make this important decision in a case of first impression in Missouri. And the court will, of course, review it de novo and make a decision. But I can't proceed further without discussing the lower court's decision. And keep in mind that the court ruled in favor of the state, the defendant in this case, on a motion to dismiss. And of course, it's clear that on a motion to dismiss, you have to take all the averments in the petition as true. And in this particular case, the plaintiff, as you'll see in the legal file, submitted a volume of information about this relationship between Kelly Glossop and Trooper Dennis Englehart. It was a relationship that was almost synonymous with a relationship between opposite sex married husband and wife. I mean, they owned and sold property together. They were beneficiaries on each other's insurance policies. They were raising a child of Kelly's. When the trooper got moved to a different troop, they moved together. They were not married in the eyes of the law in Missouri, but they were a very committed, interdependent couple. And in the brief gives much more information that you can read through to talk about the relationship between these two people. And in the lower court opinion, the trial judge made it clear that he did not have to consider any evidence to make a decision, that he could make a decision based on what he perceived or conceived to be the situation. And in fact, the state didn't put on any evidence. And basically the motion to dismiss was sustained. And
did the decedent, Mr. Kossoff, as his beneficiary on the policies?
Yes.
And the state never inquired about it, anything regarding that?
Well, the survivor, Mr. Glossop, was a beneficiary on an insurance policy from Trooper Engelhard, yes. Yeah, and in fact, he had another some more benefits in which he had Mr. Glossop, the surviving partner, and another person. There's 50-50 benefits between, but yes. And
but he was never told he couldn't list him as the beneficiary at the time he signed.
The evidence will be he was never told he couldn't list as a beneficiary. And and the patrol papers, as you'll see in the legal file, show this relationship. This was an open relationship. Everybody knew it. I think that most people will agree that Trooper Engelhard was a highly respected trooper, did his job, and was respected within this great organization.
Could you focus on the standard that we applied?
It's our belief. It's our belief that that leads me into the issue below. We believe we prevail on a rational-based standard. And if we look at the recent cases, that's one of the problems in this case, because in trying to find an answer to the decision before you, we really have to look at the date the case was decided, because this is a growing area of law. And if you look at the decisions from our United States Supreme Court and from the courts around the country over the last decade and shorter, you'll find that the decisions lead you in a different direction than perhaps those decisions earlier, particularly those decisions in the years after Bowers, which of course Lawrence v. Texas overruled. And there was a period of time, unfortunately, when our American jurisprudence did not protect the rights of same-sex partners in a relationship like the trend is occurring now.
Is the issue of whether rational basis or intermediate or strict scrutiny should be applied, is that before the Supreme Court, the two cases they've taken in this area?
They've taken two cases, and on March 27th, the Supreme Court's going to address this issue. Now, that's a marriage case. That's a marriage case, so it's different than what we've got here. But you have to believe that in resolving that marriage case. The Doman case. In resolving that issue, the Windsor case out of New York, which involved two women who had a long relationship, the one died, and it had to do with whether or not the surviving spouse is going to get a marital deduction under the law, and it saves her about $300,000+. But that case will be heard on March 27th. I would assume that the court will rule sometime before midsummer. And we'll know what they're going to say about that.
Well, perhaps something that we said in that case could be constructive to this opinion here.
You know, we think the case here in Missouri can be decided without looking to what the Supreme Court's going to do. I can see how, if I were a jurist and wanted to be a little bit on the safe side, you might want to see what the court's going to do in that case. Okay, if they say that, then that changes the game, because then that requires a heightened degree of scrutiny, and we already know that there are cases out there that suggest that, and even in the 2010 case, whose name I forget now, but Justice Ginsburg talked about the fact that same-sex partners in a relationship do have a certain status. That's the term she used. And as soon as she said that in her case, the next case of Perry versus Schwarzenegger basically adopted that statement by Judge Ginsburg to say, hey, this is a heightened scrutiny case. So it seems clear that the Supreme Court is moving in the direction, rightly so, toward, when analyzing the classification of a same-sex committed interdependent partnership, a permanent type of relationship, that they're going to look, when those are disenfranchised, those people are disenfranchised, it looks like that they're going to employ perhaps a much higher level of analysis or scrutiny than previously.
They haven't said it yet, and so
they haven't said it yet.
To us today that the rational basis analysis is the appropriate analysis?
It is the appropriate analysis, I think, under some cases. And, you look at the Alaska case that is cited. In fact, in the entire country, state and federal courts, there really is only one case on all fours with the case before you here today, and that's the Alaska Civil Liberties case. And they decide on a rational basis that the classification that includes same-sex committed partners is a separate classification by itself. If you read the opinion, I believe that they used a very carefully evaluated rational basis. There are. If you look at.
Not
the no, absolutely not. And that's a point I need to make. That if the court would maybe look at the rational basis as not giving us the relief that we think we're entitled to, then certainly. We think we have made a very strong case, and that the law is in support of a classification like Kelly and Dennis were involved in as being subject to a higher degree of scrutiny. Higher scrutiny.
And I know your time's up, but can you briefly address, you make an alternative argument under the special laws provision of the Missouri Constitution, which requires substantial justification to be shown for a special law, if something is a special law.
And I think the best argument under special law is the fact that clearly when this 2001 legislative body targeted the people exactly in the situation with Dennis and Kelly, that they were making it clear that gay people like Kelly and like Dennis in a committed relationship like they were not under any circumstances going to get these death benefits. And it was a 1-2 punch. Section 140 says that spouse gets the retirement benefits. But then the legislature comes in and says, no, they're not under any circumstances going to get it if they're a gay couple living together, no matter how long they've lived together, and no matter how similar their relationship is to opposite sex.
Mr. Grant, if that statute had been passed, are you saying that the outcome in this case would be different?
No, I don't think that's what I'm saying. I'm saying that there's the evidence of the special statute, the special legislation.
And yet you have time for about any other questions. Thank you, Mr. Grant.
Thank you.
Good morning, Jim Ward. I appreciate the opportunity to present to this court on this issue. With the court's indulgence, I just want to provide a little bit of additional background that I think would be helpful before I step into some of the legal issues. Of course, I'll take questions along the way, but if the court will indulge me. I want to say this before anything else, that I think we can all agree that Mr. Glossop suffered a tragic loss when he lost Corporal Engelhardt, and we acknowledge that. Even though this case is brought as a claim for survivor benefits based on the death of a state trooper, this case goes much broader than that. The statutory section that provides the survivor benefit pertains to all of EMPR's active members, not just state troopers. As of 2012, EMPR's active membership numbered over 7,000 employees. The statute that provides the survivor benefit was adopted in 1955. The statute has granted the survivor benefit to spouses as the primary beneficiary since 1969. The statute has granted the benefit to minor surviving children as contingent beneficiaries since 1976. I must point out that a similar survivor benefit is granted to survivors of other state employees who die in the course of duty under 104.1030 under the same chapter that grants the survivor benefit at issue here. And that governs the retirement of state officers and employees, including Mosers. Like the challenged statute, that also provides a survivor benefit to minor surviving children. As of 2012, Mosers had over 51,000 active members. My point, of course, is that the matter before the court reaches far beyond the death of a state trooper and the survivor benefit that Mr. Glossop seeks for himself. My final introductory remarks provide a more specific transition to the legal arguments before the court. First, it's clear that no matter how the appellant calibrates his legal arguments, they spring from the inability of same-sex couples to marry under Missouri law. He does make it clear, and I guess in terms of making an umbrella point, I think that to characterize the issue as this case is a narrow issue concerning an employment benefit, and we certainly agree that the statute at issue fundamentally concerns an economic benefit. But to say that that's all that the case is about, I think, is to ignore what I think is the upshot of this appeal, which I think is an attempt to render superfluous the spousal requirement under the statute. If a state cannot grant, I think one of the underlying issues in this case is whether or not the state has the right to grant certain concrete benefits based on a spousal limitation.
But doesn't the statute, and the opposing counsel strongly argues that the statute also bars recovery from someone who was married in another state that does allow same-sex marriage, and those spouses are not granted the right to receive benefits. So it just is not based on marriage. It's based on the fact of the same-sex relationship.
Well, certainly the statute defines marriage, consistent with Missouri law, as limited to a man and a woman, and your point is well taken. If you had a marriage that was consummated outside in another state that recognized it, Missouri law would not recognize it. And I acknowledge that as a hypothetical, because in this particular case, Mr. Glossop and Mr. Engelhardt never attempted to formalize their marriage through a civil marriage contract in any state that would have allowed it.
And Missouri would not, but a lot depends on where you start and how you characterize this issue, certainly. But their argument is, should they prevail in this case, that would have no impact on and in no way affect the validity of Missouri's constitutional provision defining marriage between a man and a woman. Is that correct?
I believe that's their position, that it would not impact the Constitution, the constitutional amendment.
And you think it would, or do you agree that the case, but nonetheless you should prevail here for other reasons that you agree?
I think probably technically it would not impact the constitutional amendment. I do think that the ramifications, if the court were to strike down the spousal limitation under 104.012, I do think it would have tremendous repercussions for employment benefits statewide in any instance where the state chose to try to limit that to spouses. And I do think that the case, as you alluded, Judge Steph, lends itself to a rational basis resolution, and I'm prepared to explain why.
Do either of the pending cases, the argument in March in the U.S. Supreme Court, deal specifically with the issue of whether or not a state can, by constitutional provision, prohibit same-sex marriage?
Not directly. I think what those cases acknowledge is something very important, I think, for this court and for this case, which is so many of those cases that the plaintiff has cited, I'll call them primarily the DOMA cases, The issue that they pointed out was that the federal government, although it has traditionally deferred to states in how they define marriage, acted in an intrusive way by purporting to try to define marriage and to try to define spouse nationwide, and essentially disregard it when a given state had defined marriage or defined spouse to include same-sex individuals. So I think those cases maybe indirectly address that issue of whether states can prohibit same-sex marriage, because I think in underlying these DOMA cases is a recognition that of the important state right to define marriage as it chooses.
How does this case differ from Alaska?
From Alaska. I'm glad you asked, because I believe this case is close to being on all fours with Alaska, but there's one very, very important difference I'm compelled to point out. The Alaska case applied a different standard of review. They did not apply rational basis review. If you look at the case, the Alaska standard is a very different standard. They refer to it as a three-step sliding scale to analyze equal protection. But the bottom line is, this comes directly from the decision. But Alaska's equal protection clause requires more than just a rational connection between a classification and a governmental interest. Even at the lowest level of scrutiny, the connection must be substantial. And to my ear, that sounds like intermediate scrutiny. And that's what I would submit to.
If we apply the last standard, how do you apply it in this case?
If we applied intermediate?
If you applied the last standard to this case, how would it come out?
For our case? Well, I think that it, in my opinion, I think that this case still, the statute still could be upheld. And I'll give you an example. The Alaska case talked about, and by the way, recognized governmental interests in controlling costs and administrative efficiency, recognized those interests. It looked at the issue that I think is important for this court to recognize, which is that if the spousal limitation is struck down, then in essence what will be substituted is eligibility based on a notion of domestic partnership. Not just same-sex domestic partners, but different-sex domestic partners. And that was what the state argued in the Alaska Civil Liberty Union's case, was this will create a huge expansion in the cost to provide the benefit, in the cost to...
This was decided on a motion to dismiss, and the court did so on a rational basis test. So they said it was their burden to show there was no rational basis for this, for the statute. Is that correct?
In the Alaska case? Oh, here. That is correct.
So no evidence was put on to support substantial evidence or otherwise, because the trial court was a motion to dismiss. Is that correct?
I would say... You're right, the court applied rational basis, but there was evidence considered, and this is evidence that I want to call out to the court, because I think this is, in my view, crucial to the conclusion that these statutes withstand rational basis.
I'm sorry, don't go outside the record. What you're telling us about the effect that there wasn't testimony below.
Understood, and I suppose the reason I call that out is because if you apply rational basis, then I think you're permitted to consider any facts that could have reasonably been conceived by the legislature, and so I don't know if strict...
This court has recently committed to fully benefit this case by rational basis, or in the applicant, was there a rational basis to the applicant being there as a day or two time limit because of a filing requirement here to cut off this court limit?
That's a that was a recent decision.
And that's my question. Has this court recently issued a decision?
If it has, I can't call it out by name. I mean, I'm not sure which decision you have in mind, Judge, but I do know that this court has ruled that economic legislation is entitled to rational basis review.
So what if the state had said you could save money by saying you're not going to allow beneficiaries who are 5 feet tall? I mean, you'd save money. There's a lot of spouses.
Right.
the partners would be more than 5 feet, save money, still wouldn't be a rational basis.
I suppose my response to that, Judge, would be that that would be an example, arguably, of an arbitrary classification. To go to the question of what evidence, if any, was considered, I think that's what proves up that this is a this satisfies rational basis. There were facts. No, I beg to differ. There was evidence considered by the trial court. These were the allegations in the plaintiff's own petition, and these allegations provide a fully a rational basis for the statutes. They certainly, what I'm about to cite to the court, make it clear that the legislative choice was not wholly irrational or arbitrary. What the plaintiff alleged in his own petition, bear with me. We alleged one of our grounds was that the statute would provide financial support for those most likely to be dependent on the loss of the member's income. And in the appellant's own petition, he asserted that a higher percentage of different sex couples has a one wage earner than same-sex couples.
So then 21-28% or something like that?
The specific percentages that the plaintiff alleged was nationally 31% of different sex couples were single wage earners versus 22. Within the state of Missouri, it was 29% different sex, 21% same sex. And I realize that the appellant has characterized that as a minuscule difference. I didn't major in statistics, but I do know that that actually is a very significant difference, because if you take the national percentages, that means that over 34% more different sex couples rely on a single wage earner for support than same sex. And in Missouri, it's even higher, that over 38% more different sex couples rely on a single wage earner for support than single sex couples. So statistically, I don't think the right way to look at it is you're just, quote, a few percentage points apart. It's the difference between those percentages.
Before your time is up, can you address the four factors that are identified as relevant to the determination whether immediate scrutiny should be applied?
Sir.
Identified as a classified group has suffered a history of invidious discrimination, whether the classification being gay has any bearing on the ability to perform or contribute to society, whether the characteristic is immutable, and whether the group has sufficient power to protect itself in the political process. Do you agree those are the four factors and how they apply to this situation?
I agree that those are the four factors under the intermediate scrutiny test. I do agree. I don't believe, honestly, I don't believe that it applies to this case to the extent that this court has expressed doubts about the viability of a quasi-suspect class.
So those were very old decisions. Those were prior to March.
I believe so. But in any event, I don't think this court has adopted it today. But I will be happy to.
Isn't that the test for whether intermediate scrutiny should apply?
Yes, it is. And I'd be happy to.
If we thought that was the test for looking at it, what is your argument that this case does not qualify under that test?
Okay.
Or do you agree it does?
If you apply intermediate scrutiny, I believe those factors would be considered in determining whether to apply intermediate scrutiny. I would submit that I do not believe that the four-factor test delivers you to intermediate scrutiny in this particular case.
And why not?
Well, first off, on the issue of political powerlessness, I think this has been argued and written about extensively in the case law, and I do think that there certainly is an argument that gays and lesbians as a class have not suffered the a disadvantage in terms of political power that is necessarily comparable to other quasi-suspect classes, particularly. Excuse me?
Such as gender.
Such.
Do you think that gays and lesbians have more power than women and more laws protecting
It's hard for me to judge, to make a strict comparison.
But there were no facts taken in this case. That's when we had a trial.
You're correct. There were no facts taken with respect to that standard.
And it is four factors.
I believe that's basically correct.
Before you finish, I wanted to ask you again, what's your best argument for rational basis? What rational basis for the legislature adopting the statute?
One of the grounds for rational basis I've reviewed, which is the likelihood of financial dependence.
Is that the most likely one? You think that's the best one?
I think that's probably the best one, followed closely behind the important governmental interest of controlling the cost of providing the benefit and administering it, which is why I think it's important for the court to bear in mind whether or not this evidence and the specific numbers are in the record. I think the court can take judicial notice that if the subject statutes are struck down, then the upshot is that a domestic partner benefit is what's going to have to be provided under the law, and that clearly will result in a substantial expansion of the survivor benefit. It will require the legislature to draft an entirely new set of statutes to administer the benefit, because there is no plan.
Is that what happened in the last one decided in 2005?
If I'm not mistaken, and maybe Marcy can correct me if I'm wrong, I think that court remand. I'm apologize that I don't know. Sorry, I don't know the answer to where the case went after the appellate decision was handed down.
Can you address opposing counsel's argument that the federal cases state that you cannot justify discrimination because it's cheaper, because you're going to save money, it would be more expensive to expand benefits for other protected groups, and that's not in itself a reason to discriminate if this were discrimination. If that's your strongest argument, that it would be expensive. I'm not sure that would pass the test in most cases.
Well, which is why I don't assert it as my strongest argument. But that said, I think the importance of, when even applying rational basis, the courts have clearly instructed that you have to look at the particular circumstances surrounding the discrepant treatment. And so in those cases where courts have declared that cost alone is not a sufficient justification, those are cases where we can use the DOMA case as a perfect example. Those are cases where the courts looked at the circumstances surrounding the discrepant treatment, and those cases involved the states or the federal government, in the case of DOMA, actually trying to take away a right that had already been granted, a pre-existing right to gays and lesbians. And it, I think...
What was the legislation doing in 2001?
When they enacted the statute? I think that the legislature in 2001 was exercising, this would have been in conjunction with a different statute that the court I'm sure is familiar with, which is 451.022, which also defined marriage as between a man and a woman. I think that the legislature was, I would submit, actually creating a redundancy by drafting this separate statute.
We're going to assume everything you do has meaning. We're going to assume everything the legislature does has meaning, being a redundancy is not using that meaning.
In this case, I think the meaning was to try to make the statute governing the benefit consistent with the statute I cited earlier and consistent with the state's authority to define marriage as it chooses.
Mr. Ward, does 104.140 distinguish between recipients on the basis of sexual orientation and marital status?
104.140 does not distinguish based on sexual orientation. It refers to spouse only. It the classification is spouses. There is no verbiage in 104.140 pertaining to sexual orientation.
Or, can you look at that out of the context of Missouri's constitutional amendment that prohibits same-sex couples from marrying, but does not prohibit different sex couples from marrying?
If I'm understanding your question, can we look at 104.140 separately from the marriage amendment?
It's saying it's not focused on same-sex couples. Doesn't that ignore the fact that while it says you have to be married, same-sex couples are also separately prohibited from marriage, whereas different-sex couples are not? And can you answer about the equal protection? And I was going to ask about the special law provision, because opposing counsel argues in their brief that it's a closed-ended characteristic because same-sex couples are not permitted to marry, and then they take a special law, which heterosexual couples can choose to marry or not, so it's their choice, not all.
I think as to your first question, I think that 104.140 on its face pertains to spouses. I think that the fact that the Missouri Constitution, the constitutional amendment, obviously limits the definition of marriage, or if you will, a spouse, I think that I don't think that the spousal classification under 104.140 makes a classification or a distinction based on sexual orientation. There's a separate constitutional amendment which does that. As for the special law, I think our analysis is that this is not a special law. It's open-ended because the class that is described under the statute is our spouses.
But it's not if you cannot marry. If you're gay and you cannot marry, how is that open-ended?
Well, I think it's open-ended in the sense that all classifications to some extent limit participation. And this court has issued a number of decisions, of course, concerning special laws. And I think as a practical matter, we can talk about open-ended and closed-ended, but as a practical matter, the cases tend to hinge, in my judgment, on whether a classification applies to only a small segment of a particular class. And whether you're talking about, for example, the Harris case, the Riverboat Casino case, which you had a statute that purported to apply to riverboat casinos, but which in fact created a very narrow exception for a couple of boats in St. Louis, or the city of Springfield versus Sprint case, where the statute purported to apply to cities, but for a collection of taxes from wireless carriers, but ultimately only allowed participation by a couple of cities. That's, I think, what makes these statutes different, and I would submit open-ended, because the class of spouses, the fact that Mr. Glossop does not fall within that classification doesn't make it a closed-ended class. I would submit that this case is more like the Harrell decision of this court, where it was argued that a law that exempted not-for-profit health service corporations from liability was a special law because it did not include hospitals. And the court looked at it and said, that's what the law provides, an exemption for liability for health service corporations. The fact that hospitals aren't included in that doesn't make it a special law. Or the Batek decision, where there was a statutory exemption for medical malpractice claims, from a tolling statute. There again, the court recognized that there were certain types of claims that weren't encompassed by that statutory exemption. So I think to take the position that for Mr. Glossop to say, I'm not able to participate in that class, does not, I think, transform the statute into a closed-ended statute. The statutes actually describe a broad group of spouses that individuals who qualify under Missouri law can enter or leave, and I think that argues in favor of it being an open-ended law.
Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Graham, can you address their argument that if we rule in favor of Mr. Boston, the state will be required to provide these benefits to all domestic partners, even in heterosexual relationships?
I will. That is simply inaccurate. We have several examples throughout the state of Missouri where cities and organizations, political subdivisions, have developed very carefully drawn domestic partner provisions for benefits. For instance, the City of St. Louis, City of Kansas City, the St. Louis Fire Department, and the St. Louis Police Department, and the Kansas City Fire Department all have provisions whereby benefits can be realized by domestic partners. But they have to meet very, very carefully drawn qualifications. So the answer is?
That it would have to provide benefits to domestic partners.
No, I don't think my answer, if I understood the question, I don't think my answer is yes, but and I may not have understood the context of the question.
Municipal ordinances or whatever, would they apply only to same-sex couples, or do they provide, or do they also apply to different sex couples who are in a domestic partnership?
They do, and that's exactly right. And
so the answer is yes. But yes, they
involve
domestic partners.
Yeah, I guess the answer is yes.
It's not improper to narrowly define it, so you have to have registered as that and have a
And that's right. That's a point I need to make, and I don't want to sound like I'm picking on the trial judge here, but you understand that in his decision here, he said there were only two classes, married couples and unmarried couples. He didn't address at all, at least in his decision, the fact that within that unmarried couples, there are two classifications. And that's not just the Alaska case that says that, but the second classification is unmarried couples who are of the same sex.
Isn't there a distinction for those purposes between same-sex couples and not who are domestic partners and different-sex couples who are domestic partners, because the latter can rectify by choosing to marry if they want, but same-sex couples and not
met
the basis for the alleged discrimination, and that would be the narrowing
factor. Exactly. And that was implied within my comment, but you're exactly right. And that is the importance. Opposite-sex couples can marry. They have the option. And that's not just an option. That is an important right that they have that same-sex couples don't have. And so that...
But you're not challenging the marriage for prohibition.
No. No, and that's because. Well, I'm really not. I'm just trying to say that this is a classification that deserves. We think we've heightened a greater scrutiny, insofar as whether or not they have been violated their equal rights. And you raised the issue about the four qualifications. I think the state. And we both agree the first three elements are there. I think the big issue is over what kind of power, are they powerful? And that's why this case, and I think this court is indeed fortunate and privileged to have a case like this before, because this is an important case. This is part of a growing body of law throughout our country that many courts are dealing with and that our Supreme Court's gonna deal with shortly. And it's important. It's important to a lot of people. And it's important to a lot of employers too, I understand that. But keep in mind that, to put this in perspective, gays and lesbians are not powerful. If we watch football, we see Phil Sims. He's still a young guy. He's not a quarterback. But Phil Sims, when he was the MVP of the Super Bowl, the conduct that Dennis and Kelly engaged in was criminalized. They were criminals. It was illegal for them to do that. And when the most recent Ray Lewis retired, when he started in the NFL, he was in the NFL 4 years before Lawrence v. Texas decided it wasn't criminal conduct. And we've advanced since then, but we've got a long way to go. So.
Baird versus Missouri State Employees Retirement System, which is the case where this court found financial reason was a rational basis to deny benefits. The newly failed to start 1 or 2 days before a set time to return to the spouse or
would have to say I remember the case, probably read about it in Lawyers Weekly, but I'm not prepared to discuss it today. I don't know, and I don't know what impact it would have. But let me just finish by saying that this is a growing body of the law, and for the cases to be cited that are back in Bauer's time, you know, when this type of relationship was criminalized, no longer have any application. And Justice Cardoza, in his treatise, Growth of the Law, that was the name of the treatise, said that existing rules and principles can give us our present locations, our bearings, our latitude and longitude. The inn that shelters for the night is not the journey's end. The law, like a traveler, must be ready for tomorrow. It must have the principle of growth. And I think that's where we are on protecting the rights of gays and lesbians. We're in an area of growth, and this court has an opportunity to be part of that area of growth and see to it that the equal rights guaranteed by our Missouri Constitution, the equal protection of our Missouri Constitution, gives those rights to these gay and lesbian couples who are in that relationship, like Kelly and Dennis were. Thank you.
But I think you make your point of close characteristic about the difference in power is this case is an example of that, because Kelly can't collect, whereas it was in an opposite sex relationship, you could collect. So the difference in power is reflected in this case and others still pending in front of the courts.
I wish I'd have said it like that.
I didn't project wrong.